So we are doing the audio recording, and that'll get posted to the website in the upcoming days, along with a PDF of Bob's deck from tonight and the contents of the chat window. I'm going to mute all, and you will not be able to unmute yourself, except Bob. You will have to unmute yourself, and you should be able to do it on your own. So feel free to use the chat window for comments or questions. I'll be monitoring the chat and relaying any questions on to Bob. And then after Bob's presentations, we will turn on everybody's microphone or allow everybody to unmute themselves at that point in time, or you can continue to use the chat window. Reminder that we are not having a Q&A on regular meeting nights. So after Bob's presentation and Q&A following it, that'll be the end for the evening. So with that, Bob is going to give us a presentation tonight on a brief history of the digital revolution. So Bob, you can take it away.
Okay, here we go. Where are we here? There we go. Okay, so tonight I'm going to be covering a brief history of the digital revolution. And as usual, when I do a presentation, the hardest job I have is figuring out what not to put in. So I've got quite a bit of information on all the slides. I'm not going to speak to every detail on every slide, and the deck will be available afterwards for download. So if you want to catch up on some of the fine details, feel free to do so. Now, a lot of our lives now involves or relates to the use of computer technology. And in other words, how much of our lives is digital now? And how did this happen? So we're going to have a quick look at the a brief history of the digital revolution. Now, back in 2015, I gave a presentation, The History of Computing Part 1, which took us up to the beginning of the personal computer. And the intent at the time was I'd give Part 2 in the near future, like in a few more months when we couldn't find a speaker. And since then, Chris and others have done a magnificent job finding other speakers, including me three or four times. And so now the time has finally arrived to do Part 2, which is the brief history of the digital revolution. And a lot has happened since then. So to start off with, I'm going to do a quick review of the history of computing Part 1 to lay the stage for the rest. Now, back in the beginning, there were things like tally sticks and quipus, which are knotted strings, to keep track of accounts, keep track of numbers, in a lot of cases, sort of inventory of goods. The abacus was the first known calculator, and it laid the foundation for positional notations like ones, tens, hundreds. Around 500 BC was the first known use of zero. 300 BC, there was the first description of the binary number system, and around 100 BC was the first known use of negative numbers. Throughout the years, there's been several attempts at mechanical calculators. Some actually worked quite well, but in a lot of cases, there was difficulty with the design and building it to the machining standards available at the time. Now, in the early 1800s, Jacquard developed a mechanism to program the weaving of looms using punched cards. And as a result, he was able to manufacture very complex patterns in the cloth. And it was known at the time as Jacquard cloth, and it was wildly popular in during the 1800s. And that brings us to binary. And you see at the bottom of the screen there, the Wikipedia being spelled out in binary. Now, punch cards are binary devices. The holes and the blanks and the punch cards are essentially either on or off or zero or one indicators. Now, in the early 1800s, Charles Babbage originated the concept of a programmable computer. He conceived of this general purpose computer that could carry out different operations based on programming instructions given to it. It could perform one task and be made to switch and perform another task. And it could even tell itself to switch tasks or alter its pattern of action based on its own interim calculations. This was the second version of a machine, and he called it the analytical engine, and it was 100 years ahead of its time. The big milestone with this was that he came up with the idea of using the punch cards, like in Jacquard's looms, as a substitute for drums. There were a few sort of programmable calculators at the time that used drums, like the steel drums in music boxes with pins sticking out. And that meant any programming was hardwired, and it was very difficult to change. And there's only a set number of tasks you could do on the drum. So few people saw the beauty of his proposal, and the British government funded it for a short period of time, but not long enough for him to bring it to full fruition. But he had one true believer, and that was Ada Lovelace. Now, Ada Lovelace was the only legitimate child of the great poet Lord Byron. And Byron separated from his wife a month after Ada was born and left England forever. Now, to prevent Ada from taking after her father, Ada's mother subjected her to a wonderful education in what were advanced mathematics at the time to counter her artistic proclivities. Now, these mathematical talents led her to a working relationship and friendship with Charles Babbage. And in 1842, she translated a report on Babbage's work. The report is the most important work describing Babbage's analytical engine. And so Babbage suggested she should add notes to the report. And these now famous notes were actually three times the length of the original report and contained the first published computer program, which was instructions on how to calculate Bernoulli numbers. And don't ask me what those are, because I didn't get that far in math myself. In her notes, Ada explored four concepts that would have historical resonance when the computer was finally born. The first was her idea that the computer could be a general purpose machine and not just perform preset tasks in mathematics. It could be programmed and reprogrammed to do a limitless and changeable number of tasks. And in a conjunction of her artistic talents and her mathematical ones, she said that the analytical engine weaves algebraical patterns just as a Jacquard loom weaves flowers and leaves. And she also noted that the machine did not need to be limited to math and numbers. Such a machine could manipulate any sort of thing that could be expressed in symbols, and that included words and logic and music and anything else that symbols could convey. She noted that the computer operation could alter the relationship not just between the numbers, but between any symbols that were logically related. And this makes a huge conceptual leap from machines that were mere fancy calculators to the ones that we now call computers. And she figured out in step-by-step detail the workings of what we would now call a computer program or algorithm. She devised the concepts of subroutines, recursive loops, and conditional branching. And these are the building blocks of virtually any computer program. she created a table and a diagram showing exactly how the algorithm would be fed into the computer step by step, and it included two recursive loops. It was a numbered list of coded instructions that included destination registers, operations, and it was something to be familiar to any C++ programmer today. And it's on the basis of this diagram that Ada has been accorded the accolade of the world's first computer programmer. And one other significant concept that she introduced in her notes, which harked back to the Frankenstein story produced by Mary B. Shelley, a friend of her father's, which raised the idea that can machines think? And Ada didn't believe so. And her statement on it was, the analytical engine has no pretensions whatever to originate anything. It can do whatever we know how to order it to perform. It can follow analysis, but it has no power of anticipating any analytical relations or truths. A century later, this would become known as Lady Lovelace's objection by computer pioneer Alan Turing. And we'll talk about him in a little bit. And there's her idea of the poetical science, the letter to ask questions about the analytical engine. Ada died at the age of 36, at the same age as her father, from uterine cancer, and she was buried at her request next to her famous father. The Ada programming language was named after her by the development team at Honeywell. The next major developments in computers were made by a chap named Herman Hollerith. He perfected the use of punch cards for computers. He was an employee of the U.S. Census Bureau and was appalled that the every 10-year census took 8 years to manually tabulate. So he resolved to automate the 1890 count. Using his tabulators, the 1890 census was completed in 1 year rather than eight. And it was the first use of major use of electrical circuits to process information. Now, the company that Hollerith ended up founding became, in 1924, International Business Machines Corporation, or IBM, or the Itsy Bitsy Machine Company. There are all sorts of developments throughout the early 1900s on computers, and a lot of them are analytical computers. But in 1937, there were a lot of new approaches, technologies, and theories that began to emerge. And the result would be the triumph of the four properties that would define modern computing. These were digital, which is discrete versus continuous, or digital instead of analog. There was a binary principle, zeros and ones. The machines would be electronic, not mechanical. And the machines would be general purpose, not specific purpose. Now, a lot of the next developments happened during World War II. There were major computer developments by both the Allies and the Germans. The Germans failed to utilize their computers in an effective way, and the British and Americans used theirs to win the war. The two biggest practical applications were artillery ballistics table calculation and enemy code breaking. And for a lot more information on this, you can look at the presentation I gave, Computers at War, last Remembrance Day. There were several major breakthroughs during the war, but the biggest was the development of the Colossus computers by the British. These were a set of computers that they developed later in the war, and it helped in the cryptoanalysis of the Enigma and Lorenz German codes. Unlike previous computers, the Colossus uses vacuum tubes instead of electromechanical switches, and thus it's regarded as the world's first programmable electronic digital computer. The first one was working by 1943, and by the end of the war, several were built. And the development of the Colossus was covered in the 2014 film, The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Alan Turing. And the film takes a lot of liberties with the actual history, but it's quite entertaining. Alan Turing was a British pioneering computer scientist, mathematician, logician, cryptoanalysis, et cetera, and he was highly influential in the development of computer science. He's widely considered to be the father of theoretical computer science and of artificial intelligence, and hence he dubbed Ada Lovelace's comment, Lady Lovelace's objection on the possibility of can computers think. He developed the concept of the Turing machine, which is a hypothetical device that manipulates symbols according to a table of rules. And basically, a Turing machine can be adapted to simulate the logic of any computer algorithm. In essence, it can do anything that's computable. And a machine that can do all that is regarded as Turing complete. Virtually all programming languages today are considered Turing complete. And the test he devised to tell if a computer could really think, it could be an artificial intelligence, was that if a human interrogator could not tell it apart through some sort of conversation from a human being. And he suggested rather than building a program to simulate the adult mind, it would be better to produce a simpler one to simulate a child's mind and let the and subject the computer to a course of education. He was prosecuted for being a homosexual in 1952. He died in 1954 from cyanide poisoning. And there's some controversy as to whether this was accidental or suicide. Now, in the post-war era, there were a lot of developments, but one of the biggest was in 1951, a British tea company, J. Lyons, made history by running the first business application on an electronic computer, and that was their payroll system. And this was the start of the data processing trend for computers. So most computers after World War II were used by corporations and government departments for data processing, which was their biggest use, with the rest being used for scientific research and by academia and the military. During the late 50s and the 60s, we had IBM and the Seven Dwarfs, because IBM's share of the market was so much larger than all the other companies. The other seven major companies were regarded as the Seven Dwarfs. And shortly after World War II in 1954, scientists from RAND Corporation created this model to illustrate how a home computer might look in 50 years. And I have no idea what those big steering wheels are for. And that brings us to the end of the history of computing part one and the start of the personal computer age and the beginnings of the digital revolution. And the comment is every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. So prior to the early 60s, a computer was one thing and only one thing, and that was a mainframe. It would cost thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, occupy a whole room, and require a full-time staff to operate and maintain it. And my father spent most of his career working for IBM, And when I was a kid, if he had to do some work on a Saturday or Sunday, he'd take me in and we'd be in this mainframe computer room with the punch card sorters and the mag tape drives and the disk drives and all these big boxes with blinky lights and whirring things. And it was quite fascinating to a kid. And so I was sort of involved in the digital revolution right from the start. In 1964, Digital Equipment launched the PDP-8, which is generally considered to be the first commercially successful mini computer. It was the size of a fridge, cost about $18,000, and more than 50,000 were sold, more than any other computer. And the big breakthrough here was that for the first time a computer could be owned by a single department and not a whole organization, and it could be operated by people who weren't scientists or engineers. And my first big job was working for an Ottawa company called Consolidated Computer, and we manufactured mini mainframe computers that used the digital PDP-80s and 1140s, and I got a chance to use these a bit. So we're going to look at the building blocks of the digital revolution. And the first big thing was the semiconductor revolution. In 1947, the transistor was invented at Bell Labs by William Shockley, John Bardeen, and Walter Brattain. And they got the Nobel Prize for this. And in an attempt to commercialize on the transistor, Shockley left Bell Labs and founded Shockley Semiconductor in Mountain View, California. Although his company closed in 1968, the site of the original building has a sign, commemorative sign marking it as the real birthplace of Silicon Valley. Just a year after he started it, a core group of his employees, who later became known as the Traitorous Eight, became unhappy with his management style and left to found Fairchild Semiconductor. And many of the original Fairchild founders, who became known as the Fair Children, left Fairchild in the 1960s to form many companies that grew to prominence in the 1970s. Among these were Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore, who founded Intel. And in a Fairchild advertisement at the time, it showed a collage of the logos of Silicon Valley with the annotation, "We started it all." It was later in 1971 that the name Silicon Valley USA was popularized. And this is a genealogy chart of some of the Silicon Valley companies. And the arrow shows Fairchild Semiconductor. And if you note all the roots going from it, it shows it's important in the development of Silicon Valley. Now, in 1958, Jack Kilby and Robert Noyce, working at Texas Instruments, developed the integrated circuit, also known as computer chip, and they got the Nobel Prize for this. In 1968, Intel was founded in Mountain View, California, Silicon Valley there, by Gord Moore, who's known for Moore's Law, and Robert Noyce. And in 1970, Intel unveiled the first dynamic access memory or DRAM chip. And this is a very important part of modern computers. And in 1971, they released the Intel 4004, and it was the first single chip microprocessor. And this microprocessor laid the foundations for the microcomputer revolution that began in the 1970s. Now, Moore's Law states the number of transistors on a microchip doubles every 2 years and the cost is halved. Texas Instruments came about after the reorganization of another company from the 1930s. And in 1954, they produced the world's first commercial silicon transistor, And the same year, they designed and manufactured the world's first transistor radio. And those of us that were children of the 50s and 60s can probably remember all these little wee teeny sounding transistor radios that were quite popular at the time. As noted, the integrated circuit was developed at TI, and they invented the handheld calculator in 1967. Now, in 1967, these cost over $100 if you could get one. And I remember my father had one of the early ones, and it cost him $120. 5 years later, he bought me a Texas Instruments calculator for $7, which goes to show how fast the cost came down. Around the same time, computer-based games were developed. In 1962, the hackers at MIT created the Space War game. 1972, Atari introduced an arcade version of Pong. They put the prototype in a bar in Silicon Valley, and after a few days, the bar owners complained that the machine wasn't working anymore. It turned out to be that the coin bucket was full to overflowing, and it stopped the machine from working. In 1975, they introduced a home version of Pong that was sold through Sears. Work on digital image sensors happened throughout the 1960s and 70s, primarily at Bell Labs, and a company called Cromenco came up with an all-digital camera in 1975. They actually published the plans for this in Popular Electronics magazine, and you could build your own. And it had a 32 by 32 bit image sensor, not quite high definition. The folks at Eastman Kodak built a self-contained electronic camera, and in 1989, Fujifilm released the first fully digital camera to be sold commercially. The first mass market camera in a phone was done by Sharp in Japan in 2000, and it could instantly transmit its pictures via cell phone telecommunications. By the mid-2000s, most higher-end cell phones had an integrated camera, and by the beginning of the 2010s, almost every smartphone had an integrated digital camera. The digital cameras, both still and video, quickly replaced film cameras, whether they were standalone digital cameras or built into devices like cell phones, smartphones, and tablets. Reasonably priced digital cameras came out, film cameras basically, for the most part, disappeared. One of the key movers in the digital revolution was Doug Engelbert, and he did a lot of the pioneering work in the human-computer interface. That included hypertext, network computers, and the original graphical user interfaces, and he developed the original computer mouse, and you can see a picture of it there. It was sort of built into a block of wood, not very elegant, but it did the job. All of his developments were demonstrated at what has become known as the mother of all demos in 1968. And this live presentation basically demonstrated almost all the fundamental elements of a modern personal computer. Windows, hypertext, graphics, efficient navigation and command input, using mice, video conferencing, the computer mouse, word processing, dynamic file linking, revision control, and a collaborative real-time editor. And this is a real seminal development in the development of personal computers. The underlying technologies developed by Doug and his team influence both the Apple Macintosh and Microsoft Windows later on in the 1980s and 90s. Doug Engelbert was presented the National Medal of Technology by Bill Clinton in 2008, or in 2000, honoring his work. And in 2008, Engelbert was honored by SRI for the mother of all demos. Now, one of the biggest developments of all was the Altair 880. This was developed by a company called MITS and based on the Intel 8080 CPU, and is featured in the cover of the January 1975 issue of Popular Electronics. The computer was sold through advertisements in various hobbyist magazines by mail order. Now, I had a copy of this issue of Popular Electronics when it first came out, and I should have kept it. It'd probably be worth some money now. The MITS Altair is widely recognized as a spark that ignited the microcomputer revolution. It was the first commercially successful personal computer. And the computer bus they designed for it became the de facto standard for personal computers. And it was later used in the original IBM PC. One of the key points is that the first programming language for the machine was Microsoft's founding product, Altair Basic. About the same time, there was the Homebrew Computer Club. It was founded in Menlo Park, California, which is part of Silicon Valley. And they met for 11 years from 1975 to 1986. The club played a huge role in the development of the microcomputer and the rise of Silicon Valley. Several high-profile hackers and computer entrepreneurs came out of its ranks, and this included Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, the founders of Apple Computer. They actually met at the Homebrew Computer Club, and Adam Osborne, who founded Osborne Computer. Its newsletter and monthly meetings promoted a very open exchange of ideas, and the club has been described as the crucible for an entire industry. In line with other computer clubs, in April 1982, the Ottawa IBM PC Users Group was founded with 20 charter members. In 1984, they came out with the first newsletter. 1987, they hosted their first computer swap meet. Now, in the 1980s and 90s, computer swap meets were huge as a way for people to exchange knowledge and parts and hardware and software. In 1988, the pub BBS opened for business, and the hardware, which included 3 dial-up modems, came to $10,000, which was an enormous amount of money at the time. And also to the point that the name was changed from the Ottawa IBM PC Users Group to the Ottawa PC Users Group because IBM got snotty and threatened legal action. So in the late computer bulletin board systems started up in the late 1970s and were used on time sharing mainframe and mini computers. And as more and more people got personal computers, they became very popular for personal computers in the early to mid 80s. They were primarily dial-up based services. And once you logged in, you could upload and download software and data. You can read the news and bulletins. You can exchange messages with other users and sometimes do direct text chatting. And some of these develop their services into Netmail, which is similar to internet-based email. Many of the BBSs also offered online games, and those with multiple phone lines had chat rooms to allow the users to real-time interact with each other. It was estimated there were 60,000 of these BBSs in the United States alone in 1994. They sort of faded out in the mid-90s. Once people got into internet-based systems and no longer had to use dial-up. But in many ways, these bulletin board systems were the predecessor to today's social networks. Also started up at the time were computer service providers, which many of them started out as commercial service providers and switched to consumer versions with the growth of personal computers. They offered some of the same services, chat systems, message forums, extensive software libraries, popular online games, and other services. The early versions were dial-up, but unlike the bulletin board systems, they survived the transition to the internet in the late 1980s and early 1990s. But they started to fade out in the mid to late 1990s because most of the things you had to pay for on a subscription to these people, you can now get free on the internet or through your internet service provider. Now, the early world of personal computers was mostly hobbyists who freely exchanged schematics, software, and other information. One important exception to this was Bill Gates, who saw the personal computer as the way to make his fortune. And that's an actual mugshot of Gates after an arrest for speeding in 1977. The speeding didn't warrant an arrest, but he decided to get mouthy with the police officer, and the result was the arrest. So when Gates' buddy Paul Allen saw the popular electronics cover with the Altair on it, He was thrilled that the personal computer had arrived, but he was afraid they were going to miss the party. He showed it to Bill Gates and said, "Hey, this thing is happening without us." When Gates realized that Allen was right, they spent the next 8 weeks in a frenzy of code writing that would change the nature of the computer business. They wrote Altair Basic for the Altair computer, and formed Microsoft in 1975. One of the big things they really wanted to do was to shift the balance of the emerging personal computer industry from the hardware manufacturers and make the hardware an interchangeable commodity and make sure that it was the software applications that would get most of the money. When Paul Allen showed me that, or Bill Gates basically said that when Paul Allen showed me that magazine, there's no such thing as a software industry. We had the insight that you could create one, and we did. And in later years, he reflected that that was the most important idea he ever had. Now, Microsoft agreed to licenses to Altair for 10 years and have it bundled with each Altair computer for a total of $30 a copy. He got two provisions in the agreement that would be very significant. One, he insisted that he and Alan would retain ownership of the software, and MITS would only have the rights to license it. And secondly, he also required that MITS use its best efforts to sublicense the software to other computer makers and split those revenues with Gates and Allen. This set the precedent for the deal that Gates would make 6 years later with IBM. As he said, we were able to make sure our software worked on many types of machines, and that allowed us and not the hardware makers to define the product. So in 1977, the first successful mass market of personal computers started to arrive with the Commodore PET, the Radio Shack TRS-80, and the Apple II. These three machines were referred to as the Trinity, and they established the market for the mass market readily assembled computers. Around the same time, Xerox had their Palo Alto Research Center, known as Xerox PARC. And Xerox PARC was instrumental in the invention of laser printers, computer-generated bitmaps, graphical user interfaces, including Windows icons, operated with a mouse, and a bunch of other stuff that basically they ended up inventing the modern personal computer with a graphical user interface and a mouse and everything. And they've since been criticized for failing to commercialize and exploit these innovations. Basically, everybody else ran with them and made lots of money. A bunch of the Xerox PARC engineers left to join Apple Computer, where they were instrumental in the development of Apple's Lisa and Macintosh computers. Now, during the 1970s, IBM dominated the mainframe market, but they were beaten out by Deck and Wang for mini computers, and they were worried about being left behind on personal computers. But as one WAG at the time said, IBM bringing out a personal computer would be like teaching an elephant to tap dance. So IBM decided to come out with their own personal computer, and they established a one-year deadline. And but with that deadline, they realized you'd have to have outdoor vendors involved in the development, and especially in writing the software. So they placed a call to Bill Gates and reached an agreement to license all of Microsoft's software products, including Microsoft Basic. But there's one essential piece of software that Microsoft didn't have, and that was an operating system. Now, because Microsoft didn't have an operating system, a lot of their stuff, software was developed to work with the CPM operating system, and that was owned by Gary Kildall, who's a childhood friend of Gates. Gates sent IBM Kildall's way, and depending on what version of the story you listen to, Kildall basically just flipped them off. He didn't show much interest. He didn't want to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And everything else, and he had just blown a huge chance to become the dominant player in the computer software market. Now, Paul Allen knew had a buddy in Seattle, Tim Patterson, who worked for a small company called Seattle Computer Products. After what happened with Kildall, Bill Gates and Paul Allen decided to go and see Tim Patterson themselves to see about his operating system called QDOS, which is for a quick and dirty operating system. They bought the software outright without telling him why. They didn't tell him that they were doing this for IBM. So they bought it off him for $50,000. For that pittance, they acquired the software that after they spruced it up would allow them to dominate the software industry for more than three decades. But important in their deal with IBM is that they would keep ownership of the operating system. So after a lot of back and forth with IBM, they came up with an agreement where IBM bought MS-DOS for $186,000, which doesn't sound like much. But there were two provisions that Gates put in that would alter the balance of power in the computer industry. The first was that IBM's license to use the operating system, which IBM would call PC-DOS, would be non-exclusive, which meant that Gates could license the same operating system to other personal computer makers under the name MS-DOS. And secondly was that Microsoft would keep control of the source code, and this meant that IBM couldn't modify or evolve the software into something that became proprietary to its own machines. Only Microsoft could make changes, and then they would license each new version to any company it wanted. As Gates said, we knew there were going to be clones of the IBM PC, so we structured that original contract to allow them. And that was a key point of the negotiations. So as a result, Microsoft's BASIC, which was also included in the deal, and its operating system became the industry standards, and Microsoft controlled it. So in 1981, IBM finally came out with its first PC, and it forms the basis for the IBM PC compatibles that also became the standard. The machine was based on an open architecture, and it developed a substantial market for third-party peripherals, expansion cards, all sorts of software rapidly grew it, because IBM was smart enough to realize originally that they couldn't do all that themselves. They did that to great effect with the mainframes, but they realized they had to have an open concept for the personal computers. The PC had a substantial influence on the computer personal computer market, and the specifications for the PC became one of the most popular computer design standards in the world. The only significant competition it faced from a non-compatible platform throughout the 1980s was from the Apple Macintosh product line. The majority of modern personal computers are distant descendants of the IBM PC. And in 2005, IBM sold off their PC business to Lenovo. So in 2005, the elephant stopped tap dancing. Lotus 1-2-3 was released by Lotus in 1983, and it became the first killer application for the IBM PC. It was hugely popular in the 1980s, and it really helped contribute to the success of the IBM PC compatibles. But later on, the Windows software started to take over. Lotus 1-2-3 was a spreadsheet standard into the 1990s, and along with DBase and WordPerfect, became the three main office automation products. But none of those companies really got into the idea of a graphical user interface. So when Windows 3 started gaining acceptance in 1990, they really didn't have any GUI products to supplement their DOS offerings, and they were so slow in responding to this demand that Microsoft's own products, Excel and Word, basically took over that market. In 1984, Apple released the Apple Macintosh personal computer. It came with a keyboard, a mouse, a graphical user interface, and included bundled Mac Paint and Mac Write software, and they had a bunch of other software products to go with it. Now, the first personal computer I ever used was when I worked at Mitel, and it was an Apple Macintosh, the original Mac Classic. And after having an account on the mainframe and everything, this is the graphical user interface was just wonderful. And later, Mitel decided I had to learn AutoCAD, which was only available on the IBM PC. And when I sat in front of the PC and got the command prompt there, it was like a lunch bag letdown. The Macintosh was introduced by the now famous television commercial, 1984, which aired during the Super Bowl. And by May of that year, they'd already reached sales of 70,000 units. You can get that commercial on YouTube there. It's great to watch in retrospect. Now, in 1990, Microsoft released Windows version 3. This corrected issues with versions 1 and 2, and it was the first version of Windows to gain any real market popularity. Now, these versions of Windows were all graphical shells that operated on top of MS-DOS. And in 1995, they came out with Windows 95. Funny they named it that. And it was the first version of Windows that were integrated with the operating system. Over the years, several other versions of Windows would be introduced over the years, culminating so far with Windows 10. And we've all heard the rumblings that Windows 11 is in the pipeline. So the original personal computer form factor of the desktop PC has evolved into several other forms, including laptops and tablets. And the basic technology has been incorporated into many other devices like smartphones and car infotainment systems. Now, one of the other real giants of the digital revolution was Steve Jobs. Him and Steve Wozniak co-founded Apple in 1976. They introduced the Apple II in 1977, and it was one of the first highly successful mass-produced computers. Jobs was familiar with the work done at Xerox, and especially the Xerox Alto. He hired a bunch of the people from Xerox PARC, and this led to the development of the unsuccessful Apple Lisa in 1983, shortly after that, followed by the breakthrough Macintosh in 1984. And the Macintosh was the first mass-produced computer with a graphical user interface. And a year later, the Macintosh introduced the desktop publishing industry when Apple added the Apple LaserWriter laser printer to it. Jobs was forced out of Apple in 1985 after a power struggle with the company's board and CEO John Sculley. And so the same year, he founded Next Computer, which specialized in computers for higher education and business markets. While he was away from Apple, he co-founded or helped fund the computer graphics division of George Lucas's Lucasfilm Company. This new company was Pixar, which produced the first 3D computer animated film feature, Toy Story, and went on to become a major animation studio, and they've done 20 films so far. Jobs returned to Apple in 1997 after it was in quite bad trouble, and Apple bought Next from him, and after he came back to Apple, he's largely responsible for reviving Apple, which had been on the verge of bankruptcy. In the same year, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates struck a deal. Microsoft invested $150 million in Apple stock. The companies agreed to settle all outstanding litigation and claims and to cross-license their patents and copyrights with each other. And Microsoft agreed to make Microsoft Office available for the Macintosh. Now, Microsoft wasn't being very really altruistic in doing this. Microsoft was under heavy investigation in the U.S. and the European Union for some monopolistic practices. And by bailing out their major competitor, it took the edge off these investigations. Jobs worked closely with designer Tony Ive, and they came out with an ad campaign called Think Different. And they also came up with a whole mass of great products, the iMac, iTunes, the iTunes Store, Apple Store, the iPod, the iPhone, the App Store, and the iPad. Steve Jobs died of cancer in 2011, and one of the last people to see him was Bill Gates. So over the years, we've had a major digitization of media. Paper books were replaced by digital text files, which were replaced by digital ebooks. And now you can read some of these ebooks online. Paper photos were replaced by digital files from digital cameras digital photos have become the dominant choice. Vinyl records and cassettes were replaced by digital CDs, which are replaced by digital files like MP3s and M4As. And now a lot of your audio can be gotten by streaming. Analog movie film was replaced by analog videotapes, which are replaced by digital DVDs and Blu-rays. And they were in turn replaced by digital files like M4As and many, many, many other digital file formats. And now you can get a lot of your video by streaming. And software was always digital. But the digital diskettes that we all used to know and love were replaced by digital CDs and digital DVDs, and later by digital downloads. And now a lot of the software, you don't even have to download it. You can use it in the cloud as a cloud-based service. Now, the ARPANET established by the Advanced Research Projects Agency of the United States Department of Defense. This is now known as DARPA. DARPA has done a lot of advanced development in a lot of areas, and right now they're working on a universal vaccine, which will be good against any kind of coronavirus, including COVID, colds, and the flu. They established the ARPANET project in 1966 and to serve as a background for interconnecting various regional academic and military networks. It was the first wide area packet switch network and the first to use TCP/IP protocols, and both of these became the technical foundation for the internet. The first computers were connected to the ARPANET in 1969, and it was expanded rapidly and declared fully operational in 1975. They expanded access to the ARPANET by developing another network that became known as CSNET. And CSNET was used to establish national supercomputing centers at several universities and provide network access and connectivity. The ARPANET itself was formally decommissioned in 1990, and the networks associated with the ARPANET were later incorporated into the internet. Or some of them were. Some of them are kept disconnected. Because what happened was the CSNET joined a bunch of other commercial, private, public, academic, business, and government networks to form the internet. The internet is really a network of networks. It's not one single network. And I'm sure we all know basically what the internet was. Up through the 1980s, the internet was mostly used by government, academia, and the military. But commercialization since then has incorporated services and technologies into virtually every aspect of our modern life. Now, the commercialization of the internet went a bit crazy in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and the value of any kind of internet based company went crazy, and that peaked in March 2000, and following that, there was a huge crash in the value of these companies. A lot of these companies ended up going belly up, and some of the other companies like Cisco, Amazon, and Qualcomm lost a large part of their value, but they managed to survive. Now, the influence of the internet can't be understated. Most traditional communications media, including telephones, radio, television, paper mail, newspapers, and everything, have either been reshaped, redefined, or bypassed by the internet, and that gave birth to new services in those spaces. Newspapers, books, other print publishing adapted to the internet and reshaped into things like blogs, web feeds, and online news aggregators. The internet enabled and accelerated all sorts of new forms of personal interaction, and that included instant messaging, internet forums, and social networking services. And online shopping has just grown incredibly for major retailers, small businesses, and entrepreneurs. And it enabled a lot of firms to extend their brick-and-mortar presence to a much larger market. And a lot of vendors came up that are internet-only. The World Wide Web part of the internet was invented by Tim Berners-Lee in 1989. He developed the first web browser and the principles that the web is based on, including the URL and hyperlinks, and the principles of hypertext documents being based on HTML. The web began to enter everyday use in 1993, when websites for the general public started to become available. And the World Wide Web has become central to the development of the information age and is the primary tool for billions of people to use the Internet. Now, Jeff Bezos founded Amazon in his garage in 1994, and it started out as an online marketplace for books. And I remember back in those days buying books from Amazon because they had books you couldn't find anywhere else or for a better price. And they rapidly expanded into electronics, videotapes, DVDs, software, games, and pretty much everything else. In 2015, they surpassed Walmart as the most valuable retailer. They acquired Whole Foods Market. In 2018, they came up with their Amazon Prime two-day delivery service, and which very quickly surpassed 100 million subscribers worldwide. Now, since then, Amazon has expanded into e-commerce, cloud computing, digital streaming, and artificial intelligence, and a lot of other things. And it's one of the big five companies in the U.S. information technology industry, along with Google, Apple, Microsoft, and Facebook. Amazon has been referred to as one of the most influential economic and cultural forces in the world, and is now the world's most valuable brand. They've come up with Amazon is known for its disruption of well-established industries and through its technological innovation and through its sheer size. It's the world's largest online marketplace, world's largest artificial intelligence assistant provider, world's largest live streaming platform, and the world's largest cloud computing platform. They're the largest internet company by revenue in the world and the second largest private employer in the United States. They have a variety of downloadable and streaming content through its Prime Video, Amazon Music, and other subsidiaries. They have a publishing arm. They have a film and television studio, and they're currently looking to, in the process of buying Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Amazon has a huge cloud computing subsidiary, Amazon Web Services. They produce consumer electronics like Kindle e-readers, Fire tablets, Fire TV, and they've acquired some other companies along the way as well. I'm not going to get into some of the controversy around Amazon because this is a history lesson, not a. but I couldn't help doing a shout out based on what happened earlier today. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, is also the founder and a privately funded company called Blue Origin, which is an aerospace manufacturer and spaceflight services company. And today, Blue Origin launched William Shatner, who played Captain Kirk in the original Star Trek TV series and the original Star Trek movies, on a suborbital flight. Now, at 90, this makes William Shatner the oldest person to go into space. The previous oldest person was John Glenn in 1998, who went up in the space shuttle at 77. So congratulations to Captain Kirk, who boldly went where no other really old guy has ever gone before. The potential for computer networking to facilitate different forms of computer mediated social interaction was evident very early on in the computer age. And efforts to support social networks via computer communication were made in many of the early online services, including through Usenet, ARPANET, Listserv, and many bulletin board services. And many of the prototypical features of social networking were present in these online services and services like America Online, Prodigy, and CompuServe, ChatNet, and AOL. In the late 1990s, user profiles became a central feature. Different social networking methods were developed by the end of the 90s, and many of the sites began to develop more advanced features for users to find and manage friends. They invented friends-only content and reader comments, and these are two big features of social networking. Facebook, which is the 800-pound gorilla of the social networking world, was launched in 2004 and became the largest social networking site in the world in early 2009. It was first introduced as the Harvard social networking site and expanded to other universities and eventually to everybody else. And there was a movie made about this, especially profiling Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook. However, the movie is largely fictional, but very entertaining. Now, this shows the most popular social networks as of this July. Facebook's at the top with YouTube, WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook Messenger, et cetera. The other diagram shows the most popular social networking sites by country, and you'll see that in many, many countries, Facebook is the number one site. And every 60 seconds of the day, there's 204 million emails sent. Every 60 seconds, Google receives over 4 million searches and all sorts of other things in here. Every 60 seconds, Amazon makes $83,000 in online sales. So this diagram is part of the deck there. You can download and get a look at it. Another part of the of what's been happening is started with cell phones. At the beginning of World War II, Hollywood actress Hedy Lamarr and composer George Antheil developed a radio guidance system using frequency hopping spread spectrum technology for the guidance systems and Allied torpedoes so they could defeat the jamming by the bad guys. The technology that they developed became the basis for cell phone, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth technology. And the development of large-scale integrated circuits, microprocessors, and everything else led to the development of the first cell phones. The first cell phone call demonstration was made in 1973. And you look at the picture there, you see the size of the cell phone there. It was pretty huge, and it weighed 2 kilograms. The cell phone network started appearing in 1979, and with 1G, which was analog, 2G was the start of the digital ones, and we're getting up to 5G now, and the standards are being worked out for 6G. Many of the developing countries that didn't have a very good landline infrastructure, cell phones have become the de facto method of communication, and they've experienced explosive growth in the third world. Smartphones combine basically cell phones and computing functions into one unit. And I'm sure we're all pretty familiar with smartphones. They can operate over cell phone networks as well as Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, and they can connect with the internet over all three. They typically have multimedia functionality like music, video, cameras, and gaming. And a lot of them have satellite navigations using GPS. The earliest smartphones were usually feature phones, which is cell phones with extra features like cameras, combined with the personal digital assistants that were popular, like the Palm Pilot. And they were primarily aimed at business and the commercial market. And one of the most popular of these were the BlackBerries. And the BlackBerries were hugely popular in the mid to late 2000s. I remember being at work in the government at the time, and the number of people you saw wandering the halls with their face stuck in their BlackBerry and walking into walls was quite something. And one of the big features of the BlackBerry was a real keyboard. Now, the first smartphone to gain any huge popularity with the public was the Apple iPhone. It was released in 2007, and it was introduced by Steve Jobs at a keynote address at the Macworld conference. In his address, Jobs said, "Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone." He introduced the iPhone as a combination of three devices, a widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communicator. And he was right on all three. Thousands of people were reported to have waited outside the Apple and AT&T retail stores for days before the devices launch. And many of the stores were sold out within an hour of opening. Now, apparently, earlier in the year when the PlayStation 3 was launched, there were similar lineups, and there were, as a result, there were burglaries of some of the stores overnight, and even shootings and everything. So Apple had to hire off-duty police officers to guard the stores overnight and to control the crowds during the day. And that's become a standard feature whenever Apple launches a major version of the iPhone or a major product. Now, the iPhone broke the pattern of previous phones by eliminating most of the hardware buttons and the keyboard. It got rid of the stylus for its screen-based interface and used only a few buttons and the touchscreen. The Internet of Things is basically a concept of connecting devices to the Internet. And this started in 1992 when a modified Coca-Cola machine at Carnegie Mellon University was connected to the ARPANET, so it was able to report on its inventory and whether the newly loaded drinks were cold or not. The term Internet of Things was coined by Peter Lewis in a speech, and it proposed that the Internet of Things is the integration of people, processes, and technology with connectable devices and sensors to enable remote monitoring, status, manipulation, and evaluation of the devices. In defining the Internet of Things, Cisco defined the tipping point as when there are more devices connected to the Internet than people. And this happened in 2010. Okay. Now, to most consumers, the Internet of Things is relevant to things like smart home devices and appliances like lights, thermostats, home security systems, and home security cameras, and other such devices, and are controlled through your smartphones, smart speakers, and other devices. Now, the last big development is computing in the cloud, and this concept started in the 1960s with time sharing on mainframe and mini computers, and through pay-as-you-go plans. The personal computer revolution put individual users in control of their own computer and their own software, which proved to be both a blessing and a curse, as many of us can attest to. This required a certain amount of computer knowledge and expertise, and expensive support groups for organizations. So in the 1990s, telecommunications companies began offering computer services and virtual private networks to businesses. They began to use the cloud symbol to denote where the provider's responsibilities ended and the user responsibilities began. With the growing popularity of the internet, the companies began offering these cloud-based services to consumers as well as businesses. And by mid-2008, Gartner, which is a huge IT consulting company, saw an opportunity for cloud computing to shape the relationship among consumers of IT services and those who use IT services and who sell them. So the goal of cloud computing was to make allow users to take benefit from diverse technologies without need for deep knowledge about them or the expertise to use each one. And so the cloud can cut your costs and help you focus on your business instead of your being impeded by IT obstacles. So the cloud is the internet, but it basically means that all the things you can access remotely over the internet on other people's computers. And my grumpy old man's perspective is there is no cloud; it's just somebody else's computer. So cloud computing sort of frees the users from direct and active management of the computer resources, including data storage and computing power, and it allows users to access their data on the cloud, to access cloud-based software and other internet services, including video and streaming services and smart home services like Amazon Alexa and Google Home from anywhere with internet access, using any one of a number of devices, including computers, tablets, and smartphones. Take advantage of the clouds. You don't have to back up your data. You don't have to buy expensive software and hardware, high horsepower hardware for only occasional use. And you don't have to keep the software, operating systems, and hardware up to date and current. So now we get to the four phases of the digital revolution. There's a million definitions of the digital revolution, and a million definitions of what it's all about. But in broad strokes, the digital revolution can be described as data processing as phase one, personal computing as phase two, network computing over the internet as phase three, and cloud computing as phase four. One of the big principles of the digital revolution is convergence. And that basically means deliver any content to any device. And it means the convergence of functionality from several discrete devices to only a handful. Here's the principle of deliver any content to any device, a nice infographic here. And this is the principle of many devices converging into only a few. Now, every major technological revolution has had a profound impact on humankind's production patterns and lifestyle. And this chart sort of gives an idea. In the early days, things were based on individual production. The Industrial Revolution brought us mass production. The technological revolution brought us productivity enhancement, and the digital revolution has brought us customer experience. Now, going forward, there's some projections here, but the big takeaway is in the bottom left-hand corner. And that's that 20% of all activities will involve one of the seven digital giants. That's Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. The last three are basically Chinese companies. This infographic gives you some ideas. 90% of the world's data was created in the last 2 years. And a lot of other great things if you have a closer look at this later on. Show some other aspects of things here. Daily Google searches went from 100 million to 2 billion a day in just 10 years. Daily emails went from 12 billion to 247 billion in 2010. Hard drive storage went from $10 a gigabyte to 6 cents a gigabyte by 2010. CD sales revenue went from 943 million in the year 2000 to less than half that by 2010. And iTunes downloads went from zero in 2000 to 10 billion in 2010. Available right now, thanks to the digital revolution, we have semi-autonomous cars. And coming soon, there's self-driving cars. And you can see my December 27th presentation, where are self-flying planes and self-driving cars taking us, for more information. This is another timeline of the digital revolution, which is interesting to look at. I did a lot of things as discrete. This sort of puts them all together in the time where they occurred synonymously in the timeline. And these next two infographics are a different look at some of the major events and when they happened. And one of the concepts here is that in the 2000s, over half of American households own a personal computer, and the population of the internet topped a billion, and the digital revolution was spreading to the rest of the developing world. So what was I doing during the digital revolution? I mentioned that as a younger, my dad took me into work there in the mainframe room. Later, I started working for an Ottawa-based company called Consolidated Computer, which did some revolutionary things in the computer age, but couldn't get the capitalization to keep going. One of their original products was one of the very, very, very original hard disk drives. When the government reorganized them and kept them going, they forced them to sell off the disk drive business called Memory Byte Transfer, or MBT, to another nascent company called Seagate. which is one of the pioneers of the hard drive industry. And so some of that original technology was developed right here in Ottawa. I went to work after that at Mitel in various roles, and went on to another company called Photomatrix, a small startup in fiber optics. I was the original employee. And I went from there to become a senior IT project manager with what became the Public Health Agency of Canada. And the Ottawa connection, there are several companies in Ottawa that were part of the digital revolution. I worked for the first three. Other companies include Microsystems International, which is a semiconductor company out in near Kanata there. That's where Mike Copeland and Terry Matthews met and later left to form Mitel. Xarlink was a semiconductor arm of Mitel, and they were spun off into a separate company. Qnix, which is a real-time software operating system company, was spun off of BlackBerry or Research in Motion, and real-time operating system in many of the self-driving car technologies. We have Corel, the software company. Back in the day, they gave several great presentations to the computer club, especially around main product there, Corel Draw, and several other products that they came up with. And early on in the life of Corel Draw, they challenged users to do some great artworks, and the winning artwork was a drawing of Hedy Lamarr, who was instrumental in developing the original cell phone technology, and she was also a very famous Hollywood actress. There's JDS Optics, which turned into JDS Uniphase, doing fiber optic stuff. They bought up Photomatrix, and they were a huge employer in Ottawa for a while, and their main customer was Nortel. When Nortel sort of hit the brick wall there and had their huge meltdown, JDS decided that their manufacturing could be done cheaper in Eastern Europe and China, and their development work could be done better down in Silicon Valley. So they're still around. Terry Matthews, after Mitel, founded Newbridge Networks, which got really big really fast and was bought out by a French company, Alcatel. And I've already mentioned Northern Telecom, which became Nortel, and they had their huge meltdown. And out in Kanata as well, there was Digital Equipment of Kanata, which made many of the PDP 80s and 1140s that were used by Consolidated Computer. And out in Bell's Corners, there was CDC, or Control Data Corporation, which made all sorts of fancy electronics for the military. I almost got a job there once. Okay, so we've reached the last page of the internet, and you can turn off your browser and go back to work. That's the end. And just for a bit of a laugh there, you've seen a lot of TV shows and movies. They have a little segment at the end there, sort of the outtakes and that. Here are some predictions of where computers would go. In 1943, Thomas Watson, president of IBM, said, I think there's a world market for maybe five computers. In Popular Mechanics in 1949, they predicted that computers in the future will weigh no more than 1.5 tons. Ken Olson, the co-founder of Digital Equipment, said, there's no reason for any individual to have a computer in his home. And in 1957, the editor in charge of business books at Prentice Hall said, I have traveled the length and breadth of this country and talked with the best people, and I can assure you that this data processing is a fad that won't last out the year. And another interesting one, there's a couple slides here. Ada Lovelace's father, Lord Byron, had a gathering at a villa in Switzerland that was basically rained out. So for amusement during the rain, he proposed that each of the guests write a ghost story. Mary Shelley produced the what would become the Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus, the original Frankenstein story. And John Polidori produced The Vampire, which is the first of the modern romantic vampire stories. So some interesting cross connections with various things, a bit of trivia there. And that's pretty much the end of it. Let's see now.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to now, I can't unmute everybody, but what I can do is mute all with the permission to unmute yourself. So again, Bob, you'll have to unmute yourself as well now. And anybody can unmute themselves if they want to pose a question or make a comment. The chat window is full of people waxing nostalgic about things, and there's links to some of the things like the 1984 video from Apple, a bunch of stuff in there, not too much in the way of questions. Mark Kaye did ask, where in this long timeline did we lose control of our own personal data and privacy? Good question. And Alan said, how come with all this great technology we can't control spammers and hackers? That would be wonderful.
Okay, well, let me just get to those. the loss of privacy and whatever was done surreptitiously over the years, and it's only sort of exploded in the last few years when people found out that Google and Facebook and Amazon and many other organizations on the internet were keeping very, very detailed records of them. Even the government of Canada got caught with its finger in the pie when it was turned out that Development and Human Resources had developed a huge database of centralized information on Canadian citizens. So that's been a part of it. The reason that security is such an issue on the internet is the original ARPANET and CS nets were established with the goal that everybody on the network was a trusted user. And so the very basic network architecture didn't have the security provisions built in, which basically has allowed generations of hackers to poke their nose into your affairs and scam you and cheat you and whatever else.
Yeah, I can attest to that for sure. Bob, I just wondered if you had had a backup slide. William Shatner dies at age 90, just in case things didn't go as planned today.
Actually, I put that slide together without the wording, because it wasn't even, when I did that part of the presentation, It was a couple days ago, and it wasn't even clear if he'd be able to launch today. As I watched the whole thing live there, I was sort of kept my fingers crossed and hoped that the rocket didn't explode on the pad or something.
Give you extra work to do to redo your slides. And just something a little bit nearer in the near history, you mentioned about Windows 11. It actually was RTM'd, released to manufacturing, bit of an anachronism, seeing as they don't actually manufacture anything, but it was actually RTM'd on October 5th, so it is generally available at this point in time. We have a couple of comments from people. Dennis, well, thanks. Elizabeth, fantastic presentation. Timothy, great presentation, a lot of information. Serge-Eric, thanks, Bob, for presentation. We had a couple earlier on saying it was Bob saying thanks, and Kirsten Fleming, actually it's probably John actually there, saying excellent, thanks. And Bob Gowan, great presentation, Bob. So lots and lots of kudos in the chat window. That was an incredible amount of information that you shared with us. I thought I knew a lot of the history, and there's a great deal of it I was not aware of. So thank you from me as well. So if anybody has any questions, you can certainly unmute yourself and ask it audibly or throw it into the chat window.
Just one thing. There are a few books that were great sources of information, mainly by what's his name? Isaacs.
Oh yeah, Isaacson.
Isaacson, yeah. Let me just bring it up here.
Yeah, I read his book on Jobs. It was quite an interesting book.
While Bob's looking up that info, is this presentation going to be replayable?
The deck will be available as a PDF file from our website, and the audio will be available as an MP4 file, and the contents of the chat window will be there as a text file as well.
So it won't be in the format that I'm presently looking at?
No. It'll be the deck as Bob presented it, but as a PDF file, and then the audio file separate.
Okay, I'm totally lost, so I won't pursue it.
You'll be able to look at the exact same slides that you saw, but it won't be in PowerPoint format, so you can go and give your own PowerPoint presentations. It'll be in PDF format, I've come up with the info here. A lot of this presentation was based on Walter Isaacson's book, The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. This is a fantastic book to read if you have any interest in the history of the digital revolution. It has a lot of very good personal stories of a lot of the people that were involved in all this, including Ada Lovelace and all the way forward to Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Doug Engelhart, and a lot of the others. It's a very entertaining read as well, and I highly recommend it. Also based a lot of the work on his book, biography of Steve Jobs, and Walter Isaacson has written several other books that are great reads as well. There's a biography of Einstein, one of Leonardo da Vinci, Benjamin Franklin, Henry Kissinger, and a few others that are really worth reading. And another book that's a great read is called The Four, the Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google by Scott Galloway, which is a great read as well. And I'll put these up in our forum there so you can reference them. Also got some great information. Several years ago, there was a TV series and some books titled Connections, and another series, The Day the Universe Changed, all by historian and futurist James Burke. And you can download some of these videos on YouTube and buy the books, and he's very entertaining in the way he does it. So there's all sorts of great info out there.
I found, Lou, you had mentioned confusion about the way that the files will be available afterwards. I posted my email address in the chat. If you want, email me, and I can give you detailed instructions on exactly where to find the files and how to access them. They won't be available for probably a day or two as Bridget gets the links up onto our website, but they will eventually be available. So if anybody has any problems trying to access those files, by all means, get in touch with me, and I can give you information on how to access them.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
Thinking along the lines of, like, when you go on Facebook and you see these webinars, and they're replayable a day later or whatever.
Yeah. We don't have it as a single video file as such because, well, by and large, I mean, Bob is just presenting the deck and talking about it and talking over it. And so we just have them as two separate files. So
I see.
Yeah. But email me and I'll be able to give you instructions.
Yeah. The reality is, if you did a video of the presentation with the presentation as it went along with the audio and everything, it would be several gigabytes. Even the PowerPoint deck was 32 megabytes just for the stills. But as a PDF, it shrinks down to about just 3.5 megabytes. So. But as a video, it would be like gigabytes.
Yeah, I think the audio file is probably going to be something like 10 or 20 megabytes, something like that. But at any rate, yeah, email me if you need to. I can give you instructions on that. No problem at all. Do we have any other questions or comments before we close out the night?
I've got a quick update.
Sure.
Thank you, Chris, for your instructions. I think I finally succeeded in loading Zoom onto my laptop.
Oh, good.
I actually had it running one time, and the damn battery died.
Yeah, that'll happen. We had at least one person, I think Elizabeth, said her battery was dying, and she had to sign off before we closed that session. Okay, I don't see anything else in the chat window, so I would like to thank Bob greatly for this excellent, excellent presentation. And I know I, for one, will be reviewing the PDF deck for some of that information that's in there. Really, really good, Bob. Thanks very, very kindly for all the work they put into that. And with that, I will stop the recording. If I can find the...
And now I can finally enjoy my beverage of choice.
Bet you can.